You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
Good evening and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another great night of Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, a show that explores beer, wine, and spirits, and the industry leaders that bring them to your glass. We've got a great show lined up tonight with Ian Cutler, owner and head distiller of Cutler's Artisan Spirits. We're going to be tasting through a flight of his products and giving some great feedback, learning the history of that distillery. Follow the conversation at hashtag HappyHourJC and hashtag BH101Flights. Curtis is out this evening, but we're going to bring in a great host, the other half of Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, Joby Yobi from Barrel House 101. Good evening, Joby.
So technically it's Happy Hour with Joby and Jason tonight, right? So you are part of the show. I do miss you, Curtis, wherever you are listening. Ian, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for making the drive down. Let's get right into it. Cutler's Artisan Spirits. Mm-hmm. We know about craft beer. We know the whole wine movement, the garage yeast wine movement. Why the spirits thing? Why is that next? Why is that now?
You know, spirits is something that I think it's just like the beer movement and the micro wine movement. When people are now realizing this is something that's feasible. Yeah, I think for years people assumed that the beers that they had been spoon-fed is what they had to choose from. And, you know, the whole microbrew movement spawned when people said, hey, I want to do something a little more interesting. I want to play around with it a little bit. But they didn't realize they could do it. And once you let people know they can do that, it spawns kind of creativity and a whole boom in the industry. And that's really what we're seeing happening in the micro distilling industry. Is that people are saying, oh, hey, that can actually be done. And I think, you know, very similar to the micro wine movement, micro brew movement, you're seeing that explosion of micro distilleries happening. A lot of people ask if certain laws have changed recently,
right,
that are now facilitating this. It's not so much that there are a couple of laws that have changed recently, but that's really not what the impetus behind the whole growth of the movement is.
Yeah.
It's really a much more organic understanding of, hey, we can do that. And especially in the microbrew world, there's a lot of people saying, hey, that's the next stage of brewing.
Right.
I started out as a home brewer. Started out when I was a much younger guy, and I couldn't buy liquor, but you could buy the ingredients.
Right.
And got into it and really found a passion for the whole creative aspects of home brewing. And that eventually led into the spirits, which kind of ties in with my family history in the distilled spirits.
Yeah, and you have a big family, a long family history in the alcohol business, much like mm-hmm. myself. We're very similar. You kind of grew up in a liquor store. You were telling us about, although your liquor store was much more fun. You guys sold knives and I think hunting equipment, you said, or guns.
Yeah, we used to do, my grandfather in our family liquor store up in Oakdale, California. They taught hunter safety course. They had guns and knives and things in there. Much, much safer than you might imagine.
But it all goes hand in hand, booze, guns, hunting.
But, and it definitely came from a different time.
Yeah,
it certainly isn't something that would necessarily fly today. But back then, that was something that, really was the safety aspect of things. But in terms of the spirits aspect, it goes back to my great-grandfather. He started out, his name was Duke Cutler, and he started out in a town called Angel's Camp, which is a gold mining town just southeast of Sacramento in the Sierra Nevadas. He started out, that's actually the same town that Mark Twain got his start in. I think it's the Leaping Frog of Calaveras County, I believe. That's where he actually got his start from. When my great-grandfather was younger, he wanted to open a bar there to serve alcohol to the local miners that had clung to the area. Unfortunately, before he was able to start that, the gold mines dried up in the area, and so he moved a little bit southwest to a town called Oakdale, California, and set up there hoping to start his bar, and was drafted to World War I, served his term as an infantryman in World War I, and then made it back, and before he was able to start his bar, Prohibition started in 1920. Now, there's some speculation that he may have started his bar beforehand and ran it as a speakeasy, but we don't know really much from that time. They didn't really save as much. There wasn't, Instagram and all these things recording all the
photographs. It's probably better. It's probably a better time.
During Prohibition, he wasn't going to be deterred. So he teamed up with a good friend of his named Dan Donnelly, who ran a moonshine operation just on the outskirts of town, the foothills. And together, they Dan made some great whiskeys. My great grandfather would sell that all kind of throughout the local area for sure, and then on upwards towards Oregon on some hunting and fishing trips that he would take.
So he was a bootlegger.
He was a bootlegger.
He was a moonshiner and a bootlegger.
Yep, yep.
Nice.
They actually sold some of their liquor to the governor of California, local sheriffs and judges, which worked out well because the local sheriffs used to call them up, let them know when the feds were coming in.
Right.
The night before so they could bury all of their things.
That comes with a price, though, doesn't it, Ian?
It does, yeah. I think there was a quid pro quo there. We definitely get an exchange for it. Exchange was definitely the moonshine that they were making, the brandy and whiskey that they produced out of the operation. The only story I've heard that they got busted was one time they were actually warned. The sheriff called them and said, the federal agents are going to be here tomorrow. Make sure to bury all of your equipment and the casks of whiskey and brandy that you have. And so they did that, but unfortunately they used to bury the barrels out in the field. And during the night, some of the local Indian tribes had snuck down and been watching them and dug up some of the barrels, had their way with it, and left the remnants laying
out. And they couldn't clean up their own mess.
They didn't clean up after themselves. I don't think they cared whether they went to jail the next day or not. And so they were busted that one time, and apparently they went before the judge. They got a $100 fine. And the judge himself was out there buying whiskey from him the week after that. So a very different age.
Definitely.
And then immediately after Prohibition, we know that Duke's Bar opened. So he did finally open his bar there in Oakdale. And then about 3 years later, in 1936, he opened the liquor store that we were talking about earlier. And that was the Cutler's Family Liquor Store that ran from 1936 through about the early mid 1980s, and that's the liquor store that I remember playing around in as a kid, and kind of being immersed in the whole liquor business trade.
Nice.
In the mid 1940s, my grandfather returned from World War II. He was a B-17 pilot, bomber pilot. Which is partly what the wings and our insignia here are a tribute to. Sometime in the late 1940s, he and my great-grandfather started the Cutler's line of spirits. We had a gin, we had vodka, we had whiskey, we had a bourbon, and we imported some scotch and had that blended. It's all under the Cutler's name, which again ran through about the early 1980s. In the early 1970s, my father, Chuck, joined in the business. And also contributed and ran the business there throughout the 1970s and early 80s.
And if you want to see some of these great photos and some more of this history, make sure to go to colorsartisan.com. That's where you're going to find the Cutler's brand and their website. It's got your social media platforms there. And some of the photography that we've been looking at, getting a kind of preparation for this show, is amazing. I mean, it's really crisp and clear, but it also shows, as you were mentioning, some of that coming of age during your liquor store, and it just speaks to a whole different era that we don't expect or don't think of nowadays.
Yeah, and also a lot of people are seem interested in the fact that there was bootlegging and moonshining going on in California. This is something that always amazes people. Every time you mention the story, they always say, "Oh, where was this? Was this in Virginia or Chicago? Or right. Where was this?" And that's really where a lot of the moonshine and bootlegging stories kind of get their their basis out of. But really, on the West Coast, it was the West. It was the Wild West still. There's still that element of Wild West was still here. But I think it makes a lot more sense if you realize that just 40 or 50 years before Prohibition, it was all gold miners out here. And they're not the type to give up their liquor, because
there's no other way to celebrate your great find than with good news.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's no real way to, and also the feds are clear out on the East Coast, so their influence, in trying to influence, politics out here and the legal system out here, took quite a bit longer.
Yeah.
And I don't think it really came in until kind of later in the Prohibition era that the feds really started to get out here and really enforce Prohibition nearly as much. And as is evident by all the stories I've heard, that all the local sheriffs, judges, even the governor of California, all these people you know, did not take prohibition nearly as seriously as the federal government.
Our liberal roots go way back.
They go way back, exactly right. So your family kind of gets out of the business in the 80s?
Yeah, there was a couple of things that happened. One, there was a major recession in the early 1980s that was a bit tough on smaller ma-pa type of businesses, which we still were. We had a couple of liquor stores. We had the Cutler's brand, but really still focused on local. It was really just localized to the Oakdale area there and a little bit in surrounding areas. But the recession and also there were some liquor law changes that occurred in California that made it a little bit more favorable for large corporations. And right. So, if you will, the kind of Walmart effect came into play and made it a little more difficult to sustain a small liquor store.
Yeah, you're talking about fair trade.
Yeah.
And yeah, so for people that don't know, before everyone had to sell with Jack Daniels for the same price.
Yeah.
Which actually boggles my mind because I grew up in the after, you know, I grew up in the Walmart effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think about that, everybody had to sell something for the same price. It just, I guess, whoever gave the best service or whoever you liked better, that's who you went to. And nowadays it's kind of the opposite. It's who has the cheaper price is, you know, for the most part, is who you're going to go to. But so fair trade came and said you could sell everything for what you wanted to.
Yep, exactly.
And that actually hurt your family's business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were much more focused on, you know, providing quality service. And that's really, as you mentioned, that's really what it was all about. It was, you know, taking care of your customer. It was providing top quality products. And really, you know, after, you know, fair trade ended, it really became about cheapest price.
Right.
And you know, conscious-minded people, especially during a heavy recession, tend to lean towards that quite a bit. So while that that whiskey that Cutler's is selling over there may be great, I can go to the local supermarket now and buy something that maybe not quite so good, but it's, you know, half or less the cost. And right now we're you know, cost conscious because of the heavy recession we're in. And so it was kind of a double whammy. So they, my father and grandfather decided to shut things down in the early 80s, which, you know, I'm happy to be bringing back, you know, here some, you know, what, 30 years later.
And we're going to get into why the quality of your brand sets you apart from a lot of other brands, but I want to say we're excited that you're bringing the brand back as well. And we'll get into more of those details as to why, what's in the glass, and what drives that. But I just to preempt it, we've been very pleased with the product we've been tasting so far.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's really what I focus in on. It really is. You know, I've been a local here. You know, I really want to bring back that local aspect. I've been Santa Barbara local here on the Central Coast for, you know, well over 20 years now. Started out up in San Luis Obispo right after high school and moved down to Santa Barbara to finish my school and went to UCSB for my undergraduate and graduate work. And just fell in love with the Central Coast and really found this to be a truly ideal place to not only live, but later on to, you know, start a micro distillery.
You went to school, are you an engineer?
I did chemistry, geology, so and a fair bit of engineering as well. Yeah.
All right. So what makes you, you know, your family goes out, you go to school. What we always like to ask all our guests, you know, it's just kind of, what's that aha moment for you where you're like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to open. It's a big decision.
It is. I think that for me, it wasn't as much of an aha moment. It was more of a long direction.
Aha.
Yeah, it was a long awe. I think maybe I'd had a couple too many drinks, and it wasn't as sharp of an awe as you might expect. You know, it's really something that I've just always been passionate about. It's really just kind of grown into this. I started out, as I mentioned, homebrewing. And it was actually in San Luis Obispo that a couple of homebrewing friends and I would get together periodically and brew a batch together. And what I found was we started just kind of chatting about distilled spirits, and you know, we all found a strong interest. I kind of took that interest and continued to run with it, and ran with it all through my years at UCSB. And once I finished UCSB, I guess the aha moment was, you know, there's actually a light at the end of the tunnel that this is something that's possibly feasible. So if I had to pick that one aha moment, it would be that, hey, this is something I think I can do.
Yeah.
So I've really, you know, put the last 6 or 8 years really into focusing on it. I spent every free time I had traveling around the world to Scotland and Ireland, visiting as many distilleries as I could possibly could. I've been to Kentucky numerous times, Tennessee and Virginia.
R&D.
Uh-huh. Absolutely, yeah. I really wanted to find out what I found. I've always been kind of curious about things, and the most curious thing I found was what is it? I've tasted liquor that's just absolutely mind-blowing. It's fantastic, and then you taste some that's drinkable but not so great. And I wanted to know why is that. I really went in search of that, of looking and talking to master distillers around the world. I was fortunate enough to get to distill with some of the greats out there, and talk with some of the very best master distillers out there and pick their brain a little bit, but also to talk with distillers that were struggling a little bit and try and find out what it is that they're doing. And I found it just as important to learn what people were doing incorrectly as what people were doing correctly. And also the scales, looking at distilleries that are producing millions of cases a year to small producers that are producing a few cases a year, and seeing the differences that occur there, and just immersing myself in all the different spirits that are out there.
I think it's great for guys like yourself to be here, because I truly believe that most people, we don't know why is a spirit taste better than this one? Why does it taste different?
Mm-hmm.
What are the components in it? What makes a gin different than a vodka? Why does a vodka have to be called a vodka? I mean, numerous things. I think for the most part, I think consumers are very confused. We know the major brands, they know them, and they know all the big boys, and they know that stuff, and I think they probably feel comfortable saying they know, well, I know what vodka is, and I know what gin is, but if you really get down to it, I don't think people know what is different. And at your place, at places like yourself, you can go there and see, why is it, and you're great about explaining why is this different, why does this taste better, why is it better on this system. I mean, we saw, I think you had two or three different, you had your little beaker system that was your test.
Sure, yeah, we got different scales.
Different scales.
The baby still.
The baby still, that's
baby
it.
Still. But yeah, to your point, that's one of the reasons, if you come into Cutler's, you'll notice that, we have windows open where you can see the entire distillery. A key component, I come from an academic world and the research world. I spent, while I was researching, distilled spirits, I was also working as a laboratory manager researching. So that's, education, I think, is a big part of it. I want people to know how distilled spirits are made. I want to try and alleviate some of the confusions that you're hitting on a little bit earlier. It bothers me when people don't get the correct information. The marketing schemes of a lot of things out there nowadays tend to confuse people. I don't think they're doing it intentionally, but they catch on things. The moonshine products that are out there these days now. There's all these moonshine products, which really isn't a type of spirit. Moonshine is really whatever a moonshiner would make.
It's kind of a generic.
It's almost like saying almost like saying liquor.
It's a bucket.
Exactly. Yeah. it's whatever that moonshiner would make. As opposed to now, I get a lot of customers, asking me, well, how much do you have to distill to be called moonshine? It's like, well, it's not really a defined spirit. Moonshine is more a term like hooch or booze or
in liquor. Food and casserole terms, we used to call that kitchen sink.
Right, and moonshine was definitely not supposed to be $40 for a bottle.
No,
so I would agree with you on that point.
It's to that point of confusion that you're mentioning, and that's really what I hope we can, as craft spirits, folks, I hope we can all get out there collectively and try and educate the public in terms of, what distinguishes vodka from gin, from all the different styles of whiskey, which is, one of the more common questions I get asked is, what is the difference between bourbon and whiskey?
Right.
And it's really a simple error, and it's really not, any consumer's fault for not understanding it. It's because the marketing out there has really pushed, and there hasn't been the kind of education that you see with the craft brewing, where you can go into a craft brewery,
right,
and they can tell you that, a stout is a style of beer, and here's an IPA, this is a style of beer, and that's what we hope to get with the craft distilling movement, is to educate people, to show them that bourbon is a style of whiskey, scotch is a style of whiskey, Tennessee whiskeys are styles of whiskey, and then try to educate people what the differences between those spirits actually are.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue may be that with wine, we know grapes make wine,
mm-hmm,
and with beer, even though people may not understand the whole process, it's kind of like, okay, water and grain, and we get it. But I think with distilled spirits, it's kind of like, wait a minute, how does this come from? I don't even understand where it comes from.
Yeah.
And you cook it, and, I'm just using just generic terms, but And that's the biggest thing, is just maybe that we can't kind of wrap our heads around, like...
And for good reason. We haven't grown up around distilleries. We've grown up around wineries. We've grown up around, you know, microbreweries. You know, now I love the idea that, you know, having craft distilleries out there, people are now immersed in it. It's, you know, you don't have to go clear to Kentucky to see a distillery. You know, you can come right down the road here in Santa Barbara and see a distillery.
I think equipment-wise, too, it can be a little intimidating. When you're looking at a still versus a brew kettle, there's plates, there's windows, there's, you know, pipes and dripping, and there's it's just like... There's
especially
like,
Ian's system.
Yeah, there's like what you consider like an artery and then, you know, the heart of the system. So I think visually it's intimidating as well, and that's, people have to get over that hump just to ask the first question of what is that, or what does that piece do?
Right. Yeah, I love to get those questions. I love... You know, knowing that, you know, after I speak with somebody, somebody else now knows that. And the hope is that they'll go out and tell somebody else. You know, so that the whole dissemination of information, I think, is really key to changing, you know, some of the issues that you just brought up of the confusion in the marketplace.
Excellent. Why don't we take a break, Jason, and come back, talk about the actual spirits.
Yeah, I'd love to taste some of it. And yeah, when we come back to Ian, I want to get a little bit of your perspective, because you talked about the travels that you went through and the different distilleries you visited. Mm-hmm. But I want to see if there's a tie-in when we get back to your family. Besides it just being in your blood, were you able to leverage any of those experiences? So I want to stay tuned, everyone who's listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. We're broadcasting live here at Barrel House 101 in Ventura, California. We're going to be back in just a few minutes with some more conversation. Ian Cutler and Cutler's Artisan Spirits. Stay
right,
tuned.
We'll be right back.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Happy Hour again.
Welcome back to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. We are broadcasting live here tonight at Barrel House 101 in Ventura, California, with special guest Ian Cutler, owner and head distiller of Cutler's Artisan Spirits. Follow our conversation at hashtag HappyHourJC and HappyHourBH101Flights. Also, check out ColorArtisanSpirits.com for all the information you want to know about Cutler Artisan Spirits. Welcome back, Ian and Joby.
All right, and so right before the break, Jason was asking you a question. Jason, could you repeat the question,
please? I sure can. We were talking about that history, the family history you have with not only the Cutler's name, but, you know, some moonshining, some bootlegging. You mentioned some travels that you went through as you're revitalizing the brand and the name. Were you able to draw, though, on some of your experiences with the liquor store and your family's history in your own journey, or was it really just about bringing the name back?
I think I did. Really, the you know, kind of growing up and immersion in it when I was a young child was really, you know, it taught me a little bit about what liquor actually is. You kind of take a different perspective on it, I think, and that's really what translated into my experience and allowed me to kind of delve a little bit deeper when I did meet with master distillers and you know, the people in the industry throughout all my travels. It really allowed me to dig a little bit deeper. I think coming from that background. So, yeah, I'd say definitely, you know, influenced, you know, how I progressed forward. You know, it was really about trying to understand everything before we went to fully starting the distillation process. You know, I've always, like I said, I'm a scientist. I kind of go back to that. I want to understand. I want to know. So I have to kind of gather all that information, and certainly, you know, coming from the industry, it certainly helped in those trials.
Sure. And we closed the door to eliminate some of the restaurant noise, but we had a question from our audience members who were being nice and quiet, and Andre wanted to know if you ever kind of had that passion for your family trade. Like, did you say, I really want to do what Grandpa did, or is it something that as you grew older, you realized it was a new path for you? Like, was there always a deep kind of heated passion somewhere that you didn't realize?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was. You know, looking back now, I see it. You know, that there was always that interest. You know, even as a kid, I used to, you know, sneak into the liquor pantry and I'd make cocktails and things. You know, grandparents would have parties and things. I was the bartender. I would get in and make their drinks. I don't know how well I was making them when I was, you know, that young. But, you know, I've always had, you know, that interest in mixing and creating and crafting something new. And that has certainly continued on throughout my entire life. That's always been something I've been interested in. And really in all aspects of spirits, I love, you know, beer, wine, and spirits, as did my parents and grandparents and before them. It wasn't just distilled spirits, but all spirits in general. But really, distilled spirits were really kind of our key focus. So that, you know, whether there was kind of a singular aha moment, I don't remember a singular moment. It was more of a crescendo of something that kind of just built and built and built on itself, and has led to, you know, today having Santa Barbara's first micro distillery.
So we were talking during the break about the homebrew recipe that you make this quintessential beer and then you can't remember how to make it because you were probably drinking while homebrewing. And you said that doesn't happen with me because in the distillery, because I take, you know, measures to do that before. We were talking about how much control you have, and that's the thing that I don't think we realized was you were talking about all these different controls, different knobs you can press, and something like the vodka, how many times does it take you till you get, is there the perfected recipe? Is that how you, is it a recipe? Is it like beer? Is it like
wine? I'll have to, put a footnote to that I don't think I don't do that now. It's far less now than I used to when
you,
I first started homebrewing.
So it doesn't happen.
Buddy and I would look at each other, and when did you add the hops? And I think maybe 20 minutes ago.
Exactly.
And really, you know, those trial and errors have led us to the point where, you know, nowadays I try as best I can. And, you know, again, coming from my science background, really what drives me is the understanding of all of the parameters, all the things that cause the spirit to be good or bad. And that's really what a lot of what I spent on my travels was evaluating, looking at what is one distillery doing differently than another. And there really are so many different parameters that go into producing spirits. And each of those can really, affect how good or bad that spirit is. I think anybody in the that makes wine or beer, any homebrewers out there will know that, you know, if you oxygenate your wort or not is going to change the character of that beer. What temperature you ferment at is going to change the character of that beer. And I think starting out, you know, a lot of homebrewers, as they get into all grain, they begin to realize, well, I started out in extracts,
right.
And a lot of those parameters were already set for me, and so I could make a decent beer. Now I'm going to all grain, and now I have the ability to alter those parameters. And so, you know, the trend is to begin to get more and more levers, if you will, or knobs that you can twist and turn to make a new product better. And what I try to do is record and determine each of those parameters that go into making that spirit. And it begins to get to be quite a few because you start off with beer and wine, which are immensely complex systems in themselves, and then you're taking those products, essentially, and taking them on to distillation. So for those of the listeners that don't know what distillation actually is, it is essentially the first stage is making a fermented beverage. So it is making wine, it is making beer. And then the second stage is to boil off and vaporize and drive off the aromas and flavors and tastes that you've built into that beer and wine and collecting those. Now how you do that, how fast you do that, how much of each of those compounds you collect are added, you know, levers and components that you can alter and change to craft a spirit.
And a lot of those become trade secrets with that particular distillation operation.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. And talking with a lot of master distillers out there, you'll find, you know, the whole gamut of people that are open and willing to tell you most everything they do and others that refuse to tell you a single thing. You know, I've spoken with Jim Russell from Wild Turkey. I asked him what his grain bill is. And kind of said, well, let's change the subject.
Yeah,
there's other distillers out there that will tell you exactly how much grain they're using in their product, and with the understanding that really, even if you know exactly how they do that portion, there's so many other parameters that go into it that it's very difficult to
replicate. Joey, I think we've seen that in the brewing industry
well. Yeah.
There are a lot of breweries nowadays that, one, because of fanfare, and two, because of full disclosure, they'll put their recipes up on their website and say, here, this is what we do, try it. If you can get what we got, all the better. But
yeah, of course, you try it means you go ahead and try that on a 5-gallon system. go ahead and scale it down.
There's so many technical aspects of it that you know, are parameters. You know, how are they oxygenating it? Are they tiny little bubbles or the big bubble? If you start to dig into it, and those people that kind of geek out, if you will, on home brewing and distilling, that's what geeking out's all about, is digging in and looking at the small details that really lead to top quality products.
Now, Ian, you were talking about starting with a base, though, and having records of the variants that you know are working through. I think it's a great segue for the product because you leverage your vodka in a couple of different ways. And Joby, you've got the vodka in front of you, so I think we should just talk about the product. Let's taste it. Let's get some perspective on your philosophy with each product a little bit. And it's up to you how much you disclose.
Well, I mean, with the vodka, it's really the whole goal. I took that on primarily as a technical challenge. It really was looking at vodkas that are out there, and there is a range of vodkas in terms of their purity levels and how much or how little flavor is present in the vodka. I've really always been a whiskey drinker, gin drinker, and so you know, big flavor is kind of where I came from looking at the vodka aspect of things. And so what I found interesting, what I've always enjoyed about vodka is kind of pushing it as a completely different spirit, is it really is that crystal clear, you know, odorless, tasteless, to a certain extent, that very high purity spirit is really the essence of alcohol, which is really all vodka is. Vodka is pretty much pure alcohol and water, and so I took that as a technical challenge to really push it to the limits of what I could make in terms of high level purity. And so what we've ended up with is a 7 times distilled product based on GMO free corn that I then run through a charred coconut husk polishing step. How I exactly run it through the polishing step is my proprietary
portion. Fair enough.
But the fact of what we're using, I think charred coconut husk, I looked at several different types of adsorbents. And the reason you look at an adsorbent, in this case a charred coconut husk, the distillation process, at each time you distill, you discard a portion of that. And then during the distillation process, you're able to push a lot of those impurities into the portion that you're discarding.
Now, you gave us some, when we were visiting the distillery, you gave us some very technical terms about that distillation process and cutting out certain things. Can you recap for some of the listeners what that is?
The most basic, most distillers refer to is three cuts. And when they talk about cuts, what they're talking about is during the distillation process, the very first portion to come off of the still is very concentrated in more volatile compounds. So these are going to be
hazardous compounds, right?
Most commonly, yes. There are some good flavors in there, but there are also some more hazardous things in there as well. Yeah. I mean, this is where the whole kind of, you know, making you go blind kind of notion comes from, is they're removing some of the more toxic things from the beer and wine and concentrating those up into the first couple of drops. And that's really all distillation is separation of these flavors. So by, you know, the very first stuff that comes off is going to be very concentrated in one flavor or aroma, or in this case, kind of more hazardous materials, and they call that the heads. There's also a term that gets thrown out there called the four shots, which is kind of a precursor to the heads. And as that progresses, as the still continues to generate spirit, that flavor and aromas will change. And so as those flavors and aromas change, there's a certain point where a very rough spirit that tastes very much of, you know, car parts cleaner, which is actually what I end up using it for. I'm a classic car guy. I love to use it to clean my carburetor. And that's really what it's good for. I mean, it's really not good for beverage consumption.
Yeah.
And so the four shots and those heads are removed at the beginning. The next stage of the distillation takes on a very sweet character. It becomes a very great spirit if your starting product is good, and we call that the hearts. The final process is the tails, which takes on a little heavier character, and these are the less volatile things, the things that don't boil nearly as easily. So what you end up with is a series of compounds, series of flavors and tastes, where the very lightest thing, the things that boil off the easiest, are there at the front, the four shots in the heads, the hearts are kind of the middle portion that is what we want to keep and actually what we use in our barreling and maturation process during the whiskey. And then the tails are something we also discard. So for vodka, what we tend to do is exclude the heads and tails and throw those away. And so when people talk about multiple times distillation, it's an increase in the level of impurities. So you're removing impurities, increasing the level of purity in this in the distillation. What we found is 7 times distillation gets you an extremely pure product, and then there's still very, very trace amounts of those impurities that we use the charred coconut husk to try and remove.
Now, is it with vodka you want that heart? With whiskey or some of those, I've heard some distillers say they want a little bit of the head.
Actually, legally,
the tail end of the head and the edge of the tails.
Legally, you have to have some of those compounds in there.
Right.
You know, what we call impurities in vodka a lot of times are flavor in whiskey and rums and tequilas. These are flavor components. Obviously not the more hazardous toxic things that we're talking about. That's always removed in all spirits.
Right.
But some of the stuff that is still coming out, you know, in between the heads and tails, if you will, in between the heads and the hearts and in between the hearts and the tails, some of those things are very flavorful compounds. And that's what we want to incorporate into the whiskey and the rums and tequilas and other flavorful spirits that we do. So yeah, that vodka is, once again, 7 times distilled, based on the GMO-free corn and the charred coconut husk process. Really creates a very clean, very smooth vodka, and you'll notice just a very slight hint of sweetness to the very end. That is actually the innate sweetness of the spirit itself. When you get vodka extremely pure, alcohol itself has a very slight sweetness to it. You don't typically notice that if you have a very cheap vodka that was not distilled many times, has not been purified. Those impurities tend to mask some of that sweetness that's present there. We're very happy to have entered our first international spirits
competition.
Right,
it's an award-winning spirit.
Yeah, we got the Spirits International Prestige Award awarded us the platinum level, which is the top level award for our vodka. And we also were awarded a gold level for our spirits packaging, so the design of our bottle.
Congratulations.
And we also entered a second spirits competition, the Craft Spirits International Competition, and we took a top award there with their competition as well.
Very good. We'll raise a glass to you on those.
Yeah.
Nice work.
Very happy to be getting some feedback from the general public and from spirits experts as well.
Fantastic. Now, we leveraging that vodka, though, we're going to jump to one of your signature lineup items, because this vodka shows up elsewhere and you use that as a base, as we were mentioning previously. I think a lot of places that I've spoken with when we were kind of prepping and marketing for the show tonight, when we mentioned Cutler's, right away, the apple pie liqueur, Grandma Tommy's apple pie liqueur came to the forefront. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think not only is it a great bridge for people that are curious about your spirits, but it tastes delicious. I mentioned in one of my postings, you'll not look at Grandma's pie the same way.
Thank you.
First, just a quick segue, Joby, if I may.
Yes.
Grandma Tommy's, when we got the story on the name,
yes,
being with you previously,
mm-hmm,
it was so, it kind of hit home for me because my grandfather's nickname by my grandmother was Tommy,
mm-hmm,
and I loved her apple pie. So it's kind of merging those two from my childhood. And then again, the taste just is amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, the apple pie was something fun I wanted to do. Whereas I said the vodka was really that technical challenge to see how clean and pure I could make a spirit. The apple pie is a throwback actually to the old moonshiner days. It's kind of wide. It's a wide known process in a lot of moonshiners throughout the U.S. that if you have a batch of moonshine that maybe is a bit rough to drink or not everybody's wanting to just guzzle down your moonshine, the best way to remedy that is to add little apples and cinnamon, try to mask some of that harshness.
Which is a quick and easy way to mask a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
Apples and cinnamon are delicious by themselves. So.
And what I would look to do is, you know, especially with the purity of the vodka, I saw that as a blank canvas. It's basically a white canvas to start with. So I took the old moonshiner's trick, and rather than using it to mask something, I really put that as the forefront flavor. And so we really wanted the apple pie flavor to be the star of the spirit, not really a secondary thing to come in and try and paint over or mask,
right,
something that was done improperly. So what we've done is taken essentially the vodka base, and we've added fresh apple juice. Washington apples are used for this. We use certified organic cassia, a type of cinnamon, and certified organic vanilla, and a variety of other spices. Since I didn't know how to bake an apple pie,
this is your offering.
My childhood looked at what I knew, where I knew to look for how to bake an apple pie, and that was my grandmother. So her name was Tommy, and so I've named this after her since I did take her apple pie recipe,
nice,
to know how to tailor it. And what we really tried to do here is recreate an actual apple pie, as opposed to, it is a liqueur, but as opposed to a lot of liqueurs that are out there, we weren't really looking to start with this giant sugar ball and figure out how to add some flavor to it. We really wanted the flavor to be the key component. And so the sugar levels are pretty low. It is a sweet spirit, but the sugar levels are relatively low compared to what most people expect when they look into a liqueur. Yeah.
Now, Joey, feedback-wise, I don't find this to be overly kind of viscous or syrupy.
No.
What do you think about on the palate?
That's what I was just going to say. It's the sweetness, though, is that natural fruit sweetness that you're getting. It's not that artificial. You know, we get flavor products all the time.
Yeah.
And there's just this artificial flavor. It's almost a fakeness, a caricature of a. If you're gonna make a strawberry liqueur or strawberry vodka, it's like this tastes so much like fake strawberry that.
Yeah, you know, and I have yet to, you know, some of the artificial things they try to emulate the real thing. When I don't see a reason why. When I was growing up, my grandmother made apple pie with apples. You know, you didn't make it with artificial flavorings.
Artificial syrup of apple.
And you know, what's wrong with that? I don't understand why we've gotten so away from it. There is kind of an economic commercial interest that has driven us away from that. But it, in my opinion, it's just not worth it.
Yeah,
and really using all natural ingredients. You know, we use whole cinnamon, we use whole vanilla, I think it shows through. You want those natural flavors. I can't stand when I taste something to taste those flavors that almost taste like something.
Right.
It that drives me nuts.
It's either it almost tastes like something or it tastes so much like a fake version of something that. But that's what I love about this stuff. And I have admittedly a sort of funny little segue about this stuff. So this was your first product to go out, right?
One of the first.
Yeah. One of the first.
Yeah.
And so. It wasn't Andre, it was actually Alex from Figueroa, and brought it in. And we did a double take. I'll be honest, like, oh, man, come on, apple pie liqueur. Like, you know, because we get approached with some of that. But he left us the bottle. I don't know if he was supposed to or not, but he did. And there were about four or five of us, and we opened it, and it just, we were supposed to be working, and people were just sitting there just drinking it. Like, this stuff is fantastic, and it's been a hit here ever since. They made some really cool cocktails for the holidays. It's like the perfect. Today, Lumina just put it with just some vodka and some syrup and just served it up. It's a great martini. The thing I like about it is that the sweetness is just enough so you can enjoy it. It's not too much. It's not a dessert, you know, liqueur per se.
Yeah, and it's something. I've also pulled the alcohol level down on it a little bit as well, and that was done intentionally. So it's at 40 proof. We ended that intentionally. I wanted people to, you know, I like to think about nights where we would sit around as a family and drink, you know, a bottle of port. You know, and having that, you know, enjoyment where you can sit down and have a couple of glasses of something is really what I wanted people to be able to enjoy with this. Throw it on the rocks, you know, mix it with
soda water. I think it would make a great little, like, apple soda.
Works great. So that's actually how I enjoy it. I like a little soda water, maybe a little spritz of citrus in there. Works great with citrus.
Summertime.
You know, the thing I didn't think about actually when I was making it, but now makes perfect sense, you know, is right over vanilla ice cream. People are really enjoying it over vanilla ice cream. But we're finding all kinds of applications for it. Works fantastic with champagne.
Oh, yeah.
Makes a nice, essentially a cure cocktail, champagne cocktail.
Interesting.
You know, obviously the martini that you guys have made tonight is fantastic. That's one of the other big key cocktails we found that just works really well.
It's really versatile.
So at the risk of the proprietary discussion again, why Washington apples? Do you have a philosophy on the style of apple, the variety you use? Versus
no, I really wanted to bring it as local as possible, and you know, to have it, Washington produces enough to have it kind of year-round. I'm still looking for more local. I haven't yet found that just yet, but my kind of philosophy is to try and go as local as possible. And so I kind of cast a wide net to start with and find what I need, and then I try to work towards bringing it closer to home. The closest, nearest places that I found are kind of all more sporadic and only have apples available a short period of time and really don't do a lot of apple juice from that. So I'm actively hunting for that. But, you know, the Washington apples, they produce a wonderful flavor. It is West Coast. It's American grown. You know, the other options, there's a lot of orange juice coming out of, you know, overseas. And that's something that I, you know, would not like to use at all. I really want to try and keep it as local as possible. I want to keep the local economy here in the U.S. I want to keep it, you know, true to as close as possible to the distillery.
Excellent. I think let's take another quick break, just a couple of minutes to kind of reset our glasses, because then I want to talk, Ian, about your latest product release and the future of the distillery as we move forward. What can we see from Cutler's and what direction we're moving? Again, for anyone who's listening right now, make sure to go to cutlersartisan.com. It's your main hub for all the social media and great history about the distillery. They're located in Santa Barbara, California. And Joby, you're listening to Happy Hour, Joby and Curtis. We're going to come back with you tonight as a primary host.
That's right.
So we'll be back in just a few minutes.
You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Happy Hour
again. Welcome back. Another great episode of Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Tonight we're sitting with Ian Cutler, owner and head distiller of Cutler's Artisan Spirits. Maybe it's kicking in a little bit, Joby. But we're having a great discussion tonight with Ian about Cutler's Artisan Spirits and the distillery in Santa Barbara, California. Again, this is Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, broadcasting live from Barrel House 101. Joby, you have in your hand a glass of, I think, a unique twist on a classic style. I'm going to let you and Ian really drive the conversation with this one because I'm biased on it and I don't want to cloud anyone's perception.
Well, I'm biased on it also, but I'll pretend not to be.
But this one is actually my personal favorite of your three, although I like all three of them. Let's just start right at the beginning. What is a gin essentially a vodka, and we keep going? I know vodka has to be 40% alcohol, right? And
vodka legally has to be distilled to 95%. Pure alcohol, and then water is added to bring it back down to the minimum, which is 40%.
Is there anything like that on gin or?
The primary requirements on gin is it is a spirit that is characterized by juniper, which is really kind of the whole basis of what gin is. And really, I love the fact of gin is it really opens up a huge area of creativity. So while it does have to have juniper, there are no stipulations of what else can be put in there. And that's why, you know, the variance on gin, you know, one gin to another, it can be so tremendous. And what you're sampling right now is the Cutler's gin that we just released this past couple of weeks. And is we're calling a new Western style. This is kind of becoming a little bit more of a popular style in which we've kind of abandoned some of the older notions that gin, because of that definition of what gin is, that we have to have overwhelming juniper as the primary botanical present. And so what we've done is focus a lot more on the kind of local area here, and what the whole Central Coast has a lot of wonderful botanical of is citrus. And so I really dove into citrus. We're using all local citrus out of Ojai and Santa Paula here. We're using a very exotic, not very exotic, but a relatively exotic citrus. It's not grown very many places. I had to hunt around. I actually spent quite a bit of time trying to hunt it down to find out that it's made right here in our backyard, and that's called bergamot. And most listeners are probably familiar with bergamot, whether they know the name or not, as the primary flavor in Earl Grey tea.
Right.
So bergamot is widely grown in Italy, and they take the oils from that, and they use that to generate Earl Grey tea. We were fortunate enough to have a local citrus farmer out here called Mud Creek Ranch, that generates a couple of trees of bergamots, and so we've purchased and hand-peeled all of those bergamot peels.
Is that your primary citrus in this?
No, we've got quite a bit of lemon and also pomelo, another somewhat exotic citrus as well, which is also grown at Mud Creek Ranch. And it is a giant soccer ball-sized citrus that has a very fruity citrus character to its peel. Very, very similar to a sweet grapefruit is what it would be likened to. We also use pixie tangerines out of Ojai to bring kind of an orange notion to it. The bergamot, kind of going back to that, has a very floral citrus component to it. And so really I was looking to develop a complexity within the citrus. So it's not just using lemon. We use lemon, we're using the bergamot, we're using the pomelos, we're using the pixie tangerines to create that kind of broad complexity. And in all spirits, my philosophy has always been to create complexity with balance. And I want to try and focus on that complexity and balance. And so with the citrus component, that's what we've tried to do there.
I think it's interesting that you are referencing citrus as a botanical, because although obviously now that we're informed, we know that it is. I don't think most people think of it that way. They think of it as a fruit and a a juice kind of component. But all fruits, especially citrus, start with a floral aspect. They start with flowering tree.
Yeah, I mean the orange blossom. You know, for people making cocktails, especially with the gin or even with the vodka, the addition, especially when it's in season, plucking fresh orange blossom flowers. Try dropping that into one of your cocktails, and when you bring it up to your nose, the floral notes on that are spectacular.
Okay.
And speaking of the floral, in addition to citrus, we want to, again, expand on that complexity with the gin, and so we're using elderflower, locally grown elderflower, which comes out of Goleta. There's Fairview Farms has some wonderful trees out there that are producing elderflower, which adds a nice floral component. And also I use jasmine in this. So jasmine in teas and everything has always had just a wonderful, fragrant floral component to it. And we're using these botanicals to balance out the juniper that's present. So there is still a significant amount of juniper. It is still a true gin. I haven't abandoned the notion that gin is a juniper spirit. But what we're really trying to do is create a gin that is a little bit more balanced. And I think, the feedback we've been getting from consumers is that they really like the notion that it's not their grandparents kind of smack you in the face with a Christmas tree style of gin.
Right.
This is a little more delicate and more balanced and a little brighter, too.
Yeah, I think, Jason, when we're up there, we're definitely talking about it. You get all the different components, but they all work so well together that it's just this one beautiful bouquet of all of them together. I get more of the juniper when I actually taste it than on the smell.
And I'm actually the reverse. I get more juniper in the nose than I do on the palate. I get some more of those citrus oils and the aspects of the fruit coming out on the palate versus when I take a big breath of it.
So yeah, we're very happy with it. It's an award winning. We also won a silver award with that at the craft spirits competition we just entered into recently. As we were talking in the break, this is something too that I think it's fun to tweak with. So this is our first batch that we've launched here, and while the core gin flavor won't change at all, we'll still have a heavy citrus and floral component. I will be nudging and playing with it. I'm always searching for how to make things better, even things that I think are fantastic. I want to try and drive and make a little bit better. And so there's always minute little bumps and tweaks and things that I'm always playing with, that I'm always trying to make things even better the next time. So there's always that drive to make a better spirit.
Well, and for those that are listening, if you're anywhere near Santa Barbara, if you're in Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, I highly recommend stopping by Cutler's in the Funk Zone. They're at 137 Anacapa Street, Suite D. And part of why I say that, Ian, is to your point about tweaking, I know behind the bar you've got a few vials, and in the back room especially, you've got unlabeled bottles with just some scribbling on it, where it really illustrates your tweaking and your drive to get to that highest quality and that best balance in each product. And so anyone who has an opportunity, go into the tasting room and have a great conversation with Ian.
Yeah, definitely. And besides tweaking these and constantly working on these, would you say these are your core brands?
Yeah. We've got the vodka, the gin, the apple pie. Right. We also have a bourbon.
Which
the
you can't get
bourbon.
Anywhere.
We did not anticipate the demand for that, and we've absolutely been sold out of that. And we're hoping to get that back out here in about a month or so. That's been a very, very popular product of ours. We're also going to be launching some silver whiskeys. Coming up, which are essentially an unaged whiskey. These are going to be a variety of different flavor components that I want to kind of emphasize much more of the grain flavor. So you really get that essence of where whiskey is actually coming from. So the whole maturation process of whiskey, when you distill whiskey, you end up with a very grain forward type of spirit, which a lot of people are calling New Make or White Dog. A lot of products are being sold under the term moonshine now.
Yeah, white whiskey.
Exactly. And so those are kind of the key starting points of whiskey. Once you put it in the barrel, and for the listeners, all whiskey comes off the still clear. And actually, all spirits come off the still clear unless,
right.
unless you're doing something horribly wrong. But the entirety, clean your plates, all everyone. Of the 100% of the color in whiskey comes from the barrel itself. There is several components to the maturation of whiskey. There's an extraction phase in which you extract out flavor compounds from the barrel that are made when you char it on the inside. You burn that inside of that oak barrel to generate flavor compounds. A lot of those are caramel and vanillas that come through in the whiskey and get all that color. There's also evaporation losses, what they call the angel share. It gets lost outside the barrel. There's also influx of oxygen from the outside. And then there's slow chemical reactions that occur over long periods of time. And so all that really changes from the silver type or white dog type whiskeys into the older matured type of whiskeys. And I really want people to understand the full spectrum of that. So we're going to be launching the silver whiskeys out, and then people will be able to taste that and actually follow along the journey of the maturation of the whiskey and see as whiskeys are aged, we'll launch some slightly older whiskeys, and then longer term, and people can actually see how that whiskey development occurs in the barrel.
Now, we do have a question from the remote audience, and it's from our own Curtis. Half of Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. He's listening remotely. Apologizes, Ian, that he wasn't able to be here, but he has a question about the gin and the complexity we were talking about. Do you have some other cocktail suggestions besides just a classic G&T or some things that you could put the gin with to really heighten its level of exposure and flavor?
The high level of citrus, to me, almost emulates some of the tonic. You know, when you do a gin and tonic, you're getting a bit of that citrus element to it. And really, you know, I like it on the rocks myself. One of my favorite cocktails, and I need to find the time to put it up on the website, is my grandfather had a great recipe for a silver fizz, which is, if you look up gin fizz, really is a cocktail that I would love to see brought back. It's something that very few people know about, but it is...
Is that egg whites in?
Yes.
Well, one
that could be. One of the versions of it has egg whites to it, yes.
Is your grandma's egg whites?
It is, yeah. Yeah. It's orange flower water, it's egg whites, it's powdered sugar and club soda, and it's blended together. You have to make a fizz, essentially. So there's different types of fizzes, but the gin fizz, or as they call it, a Ramos fizz, is a absolutely fantastic cocktail, and it really emphasizes a more floral and citrus type of gin like we have with the Cutler's gin. So I'd really encourage people to try and find or look up and get a gin fizz and give it a try, because it really is one of those spectacular cocktails that hardly anybody seems to know about anymore.
I don't think I've ever had one, but Curtis, there you go. I think we have to make one for all three of us.
Cutler's gin fizz, right?
Gin
there.
Fizz, yeah.
So with that being said, though, Ian, where can some of our listeners find your product? We know that you're focused on the local community of Santa Barbara and really building that brand, but how do they get a hold of this bottle?
We're in quite a few places, especially locally around the Santa Barbara Ventura area here, obviously, Barrel House 101. You can come and grab cocktails here. There's a number of places that are listed on my website. If you go to my website, you can look up on there, and I've got quite a few places that are listing. We're going to be revamping that here just shortly and adding quite a few new places that we do not have on there currently. But
all right.
I think the website's the best place to go and look for that.
And if we want to visit you, what are your hours? When are you?
Currently, we're open Thursday through Sunday, 1 to 6. Okay. We are in the Funk Zone there in Santa Barbara. So if you come down there, we've got great beer, wine, and spirits, and food. Anybody that hasn't been to the Funk Zone, I highly encourage
you. Do yourself a favor, yeah.
And for those people coming from outside of the Santa Barbara area, the train station does drop off about 2 blocks away, so definitely looking to take an Amtrak up. It's a great way to spend your weekend.
Yeah.
We will be going to broader hours, and you can check our website for that as we approach the Sunday.
Very good. And again, for everyone listening, that website is colorsartisan.com. Also, you have Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to build up your Twitter. I know we were talking earlier, yes. Ian, about the Twitter account, but you got some great followers, so we're going to get some content there. And Facebook, going to the photography and the history and the products themselves, Facebook's a great place for you to find that information.
Yeah, please like us on Facebook. We do. I spend, although I don't get as much time as I like to in social media, I probably put most of my focus into Facebook and Instagram, and I'm learning about Twitter. So hopefully we'll be starting to do a little bit more Twitter.
So you don't have a social media department yet?
You're looking at it.
If anyone who's watching on camera, faintly, you'll see ghost images of about 5, 6, or 7 hats, depending on the topic of conversation that Ian wears. But the cocktails that we're featuring here tonight, I think they were a big hit. That the ginger and the vodka mix with a little bit of lemon peel really accentuated some beautiful sweetness and flavors of that vodka. And as we were talking about the gin, there's enough citrus there that over the rocks or with a little bit of a spritzer is going to highlight some really wonderful aroma and great flavor. I'm really happy and appreciate you coming in tonight, Ian. The time you spent has been fantastic with us.
Definitely. Anything else you want to plug?
No, I think thank you guys very much for having me here. It's been great chatting with you guys.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
So it's been a happy hour with Joby and Jason today.
And a big shout out again to Curtis. He's doing the responsible dad thing. he's at his daughter's open house for school, talking about your grandfather and your father and that, you know, the history and the education. You can't plug that enough. So, Curtis, we tip our hat to you. We raise a glass of gin. Unfortunately, you don't have any.
Yeah, right. And thanks to Andre from Figueroa Mountain also.
Most definitely.
For providing the great spirits.
We have some great shows coming up. So, like the Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis Facebook page. Get on board with that. And you're going to see some events and postings coming up with some other really wonderful vendors and some great industry leaders when it comes to beverage. Coming down the pipe, Joby, I don't want to put any cats out of the bag, but you and I have talked about some really cool stuff that you and Curtis will be leading discussions on. So
I'm looking forward to this summer, actually. It's going to be
starting with the Firestone Invitational next weekend.
You are having some technical difficulties. We need to get your mic some gin. But yeah, Firestone Walker Invitational is coming up next weekend, and we're definitely going to have a little recap of that. Again, wonderful evening. Ian, thank you so much tonight.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, broadcasting live from Barrel House 101. Stay tuned for a couple of our great sponsors, but thank you all for joining us tonight. Stay tuned for some more great episodes coming down the pipe.
You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Thanks for listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. If you like this podcast, make sure you like us on iTunes. You can also find us on Facebook under Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Give us a like and share it with all your friends. We'd appreciate it. Cheers!